Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Kuf Ayin Bet Amud Aleph, three lines down. Amaluhu Robo, and there seems to be an alternate girsa that's Rabbo, Barbar of Shila, Lahanu Katvei Shtara. He said to the individuals who draw up the Ishtarot, the Sofrim, when it comes to Shtara Akniata, Ki Katvitu Shtari Akniata, when you write or you guys pen these documents of acquisition, Iyadiitu Yoma de Kanitu Bey, if you know the date upon which the transaction took place, kitfu, then you should write it. You should put the date based on the date of the actual transaction. Ve'i lo, if you don't know the actual date of the transaction, kitfu yoma de kamitu bay, then you should put the date upon which you are writing the shtar, or the date that you are at currently. So that it shouldn't look like there's a forgery or a lie that's taking place, that you're dating it otherwise from the date that you're sitting on. If you date it based on the day that you're sitting on, that's fine, because it doesn't look like you're lying, it doesn't look like you're making up anything. And if you know the actual date of the transaction, then obviously putting the date in is the correct thing to do, because that's the date of the transaction. So now, over here, the question of what a shtar akniato is, and number one, and number two is, what is that in contrast to? So here the Rishbam notes that when we're speaking about a shtar akniato, we're speaking about kotvei shtar matana she'en kavtuv ben akrayut. It's a gift without any recourse written into it. That's one type of akniato. Or shtar mechira she'kavtuv ben akrayut. Or it's a sale with recourse in it. And in both of these instances, it's okay to write the shtar. Number one, given the date that you're on currently, it's fine to write it. Or it's fine to write the date of the original transaction. Because, and now here the Rishbam explains why that's the case, the edim mafkile the kala below shtar. Because over here, the edim spread the word even without a shtar. So this goes back to something we've discussed numerous times in the Masechta and before, which is that when it comes to a shtar, when it comes to something that is transacted and then documented in a shtar, we always say that the shtar is a mechanism for publicity. It's as if there's now a public title being spread or indicated through the shtar and the edim that are signed on it. Because we assume that the edim who sign on it will publicize the matter. They have friends, and those friends have friends, and the information will circulate. So we've always said that if you have a milveh b'shtar, if you have a loan that is documented by a shtar, then that milveh has a lien on the debtor's property, and anybody who buys subsequent to that is taking the risk that he might be foreclosed upon because he knows about the information. Any milveh b'shtar is considered to be a public event. On the other hand, a milveh al peh, when you have an oral transaction, we only allow you to take from free and clear property, not to take from encumbered property, because that's something that does not spread. It does not have the type of publicity associated with a shtar that is signed by edim. Now, that distinction is really a distinction in a halva'ah, in a loan. The reason being is that people who borrow money don't try to publicize the fact that they are borrowing the money. Anybody who borrows, the Gemara says, bitzina. He does it quietly. He tries to do it in a manner that does not attract attention. So in the case of a milveh al peh, we're going to assume that there is no publicity to the loan. Number one, because the debtor himself has no interest or vested interest in spreading the fact that he's borrowing the money. And number two is we don't have a document or something that will generate the type of publicity that, despite the fact that the debtor doesn't want it to spread, that it will spread anyway. For that reason, we consider it to be almost like a private or quiet transaction where we can't hold buyers responsible for not knowing about it. On the other hand, if you have a shtar, a milveh b'shtar, despite the fact that the debtor might not want to publicize the information or make the public knowledge that he's borrowing money, the fact that it's done on a shtar and that there are edim signed to it already makes it a matter of the public record. And therefore, we expect people to know about it, and we assume that that information will spread to the public at large. Again, that's a unique aspect of a halva'ah, because there, the party, the debtor, has a vested interest in keeping it quiet. And then when it comes to mechira, when it comes to a sale, you don't have that mitigating factor that the party wants to keep it private. The purchaser of the property actually has a vested interest in the opposite direction. Purchase the property actually has a vested interest in seeing the information be publicized. Now, of course, there are people who like to do quiet transactions and non-public transactions. But in their day where there was no title that was passed, and there's no records that were kept, the only thing that really protected the individual was the publicity associated with the transaction that gave the individual the right to say that I was the purchaser of the property or I am the purchaser of the property. So in that case, the purchaser here actually has a vested interest in seeing the information publicized. And for that reason, the edim that are associated with the transaction, they will publicize the information even without a shtar. And so therefore, by a akna'a, or by a purchase, we don't have the same worry, or we don't have the same issue that we have by a halva'a. That means no matter how the transaction took place, we are going to assume that the edim who witnessed the transaction, who are necessary for the transaction to go through, because without witnesses, you don't have a kinyan. You don't have the mechanism by which someone can bring evidence to the fact that they purchased the property. So they're definitely edim to the event. And we're going to assume that that will bring publicity to the event, because again, the party has a vested interest in seeing that publicity happen to protect his ownership of the property. So that's what the Rashbam says over here. The edim, makile de kava b'lo shtar. But the edim caused the publicity of this matter even without any documentation. And that's why then the Rashbam says, v'davka shtari aknayata. That is only true when we're talking about documents of acquisition. Of a shtari halva'a, when you're talking about a document of borrowing, a credit document, sheish b'achayut, that has recourse, lo yichtov. Then the sofrim that are writing, eliyom shomeid b'achshav. You're only allowed to date it the day upon which you are writing it. Dimken havalei mukdam upasul. Because otherwise, it's considered to be a predated shtar and is pasul. Dati the mitzvah lekuchot, because then you can use this document to go and foreclose on buyers. So what the Rashbam is noting is that there's a fundamental difference, which the Gemara notes in other places, between halva'ah and mechira. That fundamental difference also makes a difference with regards to the ownership or the subsequent buyer's knowledge of the transaction. So when it comes to borrowing of money, the actual document itself and the signing of the document is what generates the publicity. So until the document is signed and until there is edim on a document, we don't assume that other parties know about the halva. And therefore, the creditor is not given a lien on the property until that happens. So if they only documented the loan later on or when they came to the sofer, that's the moment at which the lien begins. The lien doesn't begin from the time of the loan extension. It begins from the time that the shtar is written and signed. That is not true by shtari aknayato. When it comes to documents of acquisition, the publicity already starts from the moment the transaction took place, because there were edim, there were witnesses to that, and we rely on those witnesses to cause the publicity. The signing of the shtar, or the writing of the shtar, is really, in a sense, a document of ra'aya, of proof that this took place, but the publicity already happened previous to this point. And so therefore, if you come to the sofer today, and they're dating it back to the time that the actual transaction took place, there's nothing wrong with that. The lekuchot, the subsequent buyers, would have been aware of the fact that there was a transaction earlier. Because again, you don't need a shtar for the publicity surrounding an acquisition in these cases. And so given that, you have the ability of the sofer to predate the shtar back to the date of the transaction. Assuming that they know when the transaction took place, assuming they have the information that indicates when the transaction took place. Absent that information, then they have to date it the current date and assume that today was the date of the acquisition. Because edim, hachatumim on the shtar, inu mafkele dekala. When it comes to halva'a, or borrowing, then it's edim on the shtar that caused the publicity, and therefore you can only date it based on the date of the shtar. And so that's what the Rashbam explains over here, is the difference between a document of credit versus a document of acquisition. And that's what's being said over here by Rabbi Bar Shila to the Sofrim, that when it comes to these shtari aknayot or shtarot, that evidence acquisitions, you can either date them today, because that's when the transaction took place, or if you know when the transaction took place, or you have edim telling you when the transaction took place, you can date the shtar based on when they tell you the transaction took place, because we would assume that if the transaction did take place, and we're telling the truth here, and the edim are telling the truth here, then we can assume that the publicity of that event already took place, and you're not hurting anybody by dating it to the original date of the transaction rather than the current date. So that's the way that the Rashbam explains it, and you can see in the Balei Tosafot he summarizes what the Rishbam says over here. And he says, Vishtari Aknayota Davka, Aval Bahal Vaot, Lomari, Kach Perish Rishbam. That's the way that the Rishbam explains it. The Omeri, and the Ri adds on, and again the Rishbam says something similar, Lo Shna Bemecher, Lo Shna Bematana Mairi. Doesn't matter whether the acquisition is a Mecher or the acquisition is a Matana. That already the Rishbam also distinguished. Although he did say that by a matana, it's only if it's below achrayut, if it's without recourse, versus a case of a mechira, it can be true even if you have recourse by the case of a mechira. Then the Rashbam quotes from the Rabbeinu Chananel, based on our Gemara, Pasat Rabbeinu Chananel, Perish, Tahada Rabbi Bashila, from Rabbi Bashila Shmeina, you would infer, the Shtara Dichtiv Bahau Yoma Dekanumine, that if you have a shtar that is written based on the date that the transaction took place, Ubatar Kama Yome Asidu Ale Hanu Sade Kamai, and after a couple of days the Edim show up to testify about it, Shapir Dami, then it's totally fine. So if they draw up a shtar on the date of the transaction, you have a halva'a, you have some sort of borrowing document of credit that the creditor and debtor draw up, and the Edim show up 3 days later to testify about the fact that this shtar is a valid shtar, that the sofer can write it up, that they can sign it, and they can date it, and the sofer can write on their behalf the relevant pieces of information. So there the Rabbeinu Chananel suggests that based on our Gemara, that would be totally fine. Because our Gemara says, if you know the day of the transaction, you can write that day in the shtar. Even though Edim are only signing on the day that the sofer is writing it. That's clearly why he's writing it. He's writing it so that the Edim can sign on the document. So despite the fact that he's writing it today, he's able to predate the shtar, because we know that the transaction took place earlier. And so what the Rabbeinu Chananel does is extrapolates that and says, that would be true in a shtara, that you could, if the Edim show up a couple of days later and tell you that it is correct, that shtar, you could date it based on that previous date and create the whole transaction, or the interaction be predated rather than today's date. And then the Rishbam writes, Ach lo yitachein. Says whatever the Rabbeinu Chananel says here is impossible. Elikamoshe perashti. As I explained, ukiperashti matnit in the git. That you have to draw a distinction between a shtar and a halva'a. And the Rabbeinu Chananel over here, who blurs that distinction and extrapolates from what's said here to documents of halva'a, is incorrectly understanding what Rabbi Bar Shila says over here. So not only does the Rishbam, again, make this distinction between shtar mechir and shtar halva'a, he does it in the face of the Rabbeinu Chananel and other Rishonim. It's almost saying the opposite, which is that you can extrapolate from the shtar aknayota to other shtarot, because generally transactions are engaged in or made with the intent to be documented. And therefore, if you have a kinyan that will, in the end, be documented, that kinyan in and of itself is enough to generate the liens, and you don't need the documentation. The documentation just helps to enhance that transaction or that kinyan that took place before and publicize it, but the lien is effective from the time of the kinyan. And the Rishbam says that's an incorrect understanding or an incorrect extrapolation of the din. All right, so now, Amaluhu Rav L'Safrei. Rav said to his Sofrim, V'chein Amaluhu Rav Huna L'Safrei, and Rav Huna Talmid of Rav also said to his Sofrim, Kikai mitu b'shile, kitvu b'shile. If you are located in Shile, you should write in the document that the document is being drawn up in the location where you are writing it. V'avagav d'misirin l'chu milei b'hinei. Even though the information was given to you in Hine, in this alternate location, in that you write in the document the place where you are writing or drawing up the document, not the place where either the information was conveyed to you, or the place where you had knowledge of the event that you're going to draw up about. And the same is true in the opposite. Kikamitu behine, kitvu behine, afagav de misirin lechumile bishile. So again, in the opposite direction, if you are located in Hine, you should write that as the locus of the shtar, even though the information was conveyed to you, even if the transaction took place in Shile. And if you look in the Rashbam, he over here qualifies that and says that even though you're writing a location where you are writing the shtar, nevertheless, you have to indicate the fact that it actually took place, or the witnessing of the event was somewhere else, which is, Klomar, b'makom plenu katavnu hach, in such and such a location we wrote or documented this transaction, that which we witnessed in the other location. So he has to give you the information about both where the shtar was drawn up, as well as where the event took place or where it was witnessed. So it's not enough if you're sitting in this location, you can't write the location of where the transaction took place. Again, because then it looks like sheker, it looks like a lie, and you have problems because the edim who are signing on it are going to be in a certain location. So you have to write the location where it's all taking place. But you can describe, or you should describe in the shtar, that it is evidencing an event or a transaction that took place in the alternate location. So according to the Rashbam, you have to put in both pieces of information. Most importantly, what's being highlighted here is the location where the shtar is being drawn up, despite the fact that the event or the transaction or the witnessing of the transaction took place in another venue. So that when people come to testify about it and say, how could you be there, Imanu Aitem? Is that really true? Oh, it took place in Healy, and you're telling me that it was done in Hine? How could you say that you were with us? So the truth is that they were there. They were in this other location, but that's because the shtar was drawn up in that location, not because where the transaction took place. It helps us to understand where the events took place, where it was drawn up, and then the veracity or the ability to validate the testimony of the edim is then made clearer if other edim come testify against them, both for the positive or the negative. And that it's now understood that the edim could be signing on a document not in the location where the events took place. Although the other Rishonim think that you just need to indicate the location as to where the shtar is being signed, that is sufficient. Meaning that you have to choose between one of those two locations. You should opt for writing down the location where the shtar is being drawn up and not the location of the event. So unlike the Rashbam, who requires both pieces of information to be in the shtar, other Rishonim believe that it's sufficient just to have the location of where the shtar is drawn up, because then we can find the Edei Chatima, we can know which currency to use in terms of determining what the amounts are in the shtar, other pieces of information that are important based on location. From there, then we can extrapolate or figure out what the other information is that we need to know. Just to note, that you see in the Balei Tosfot over here, when he says, Hinei v'shilei krovot zo lezo. These are two cities that are very proximate to each other. And that's why they brought them as an example. Shafilu b'shtei ayarot krovot zo lezo. Even though these locations are so proximate to each other, so close to each other, you still should write the proper city in which you are documenting the transaction. And even though it's frequent that you're going to have transactions taking place in one and documented in the other, and people would know that or possibly know that, still you should draw up that differentiation in order for people to understand that even when you're close by, you have to do this. And certainly when you are further away, you have to document in that way. Others read just the opposite of the Balei Tosafot, that Shile Vihine are locations that are very far from each other. And that's what it's indicating. Just like in these places where they're far away, and it's obvious that you have to put down the location where you document it, it's true in any two places or two locations that you have to document it in such a manner. So Amar Rava, Haiman Denokit Shtara Bar Meir Zuzay. An individual has a credit document which entitles him to collect 100 zuz. The Amar, he goes to the sofer without the lovel, without the debtor with him, and he says, Shavu Ni'alei Trei Bnei Chamshin Chamshin. He says to the sofer, break it up into 250 documents. Basically, he's saying, give me change. Saying, I'll give you 100. I'll give you a shtar that says I'm entitled to 100. Write me up two shtarot that say that I'm entitled to 50 plus 50. It should be indifferent. 50 plus 50 is equal to 100. Rava says, or again here, the possible gear says, Rabbo is, lo mishavin and lohu. We do not acquiesce to his request, and we do not do this. So again, here, it's the absence of the lovah. We don't allow him to break it down into two separate documents. My taima, what's the reason we don't allow him to do this? Avdu rabbonon milto, v'nechle l'malve, v'nechle l'love. We do something that is to the benefit of both parties in the transaction. The Rabbanan instituted that you may not do this for the protection of the Malveh and for the protection of the Loveh. Nechale le Malveh, it's better for the Malveh to be in this situation or to have it remain this way. So that means if the debtor came and made the request, we still would not acquiesce to it because of this problem, which is Kedei Shikof le Poro. It's something that we've seen over and over again, that the larger the amount in the shtar, the more pressure the malveh, the creditor, can apply to the debtor. So over here, for the malveh to have a bigger number in the outstanding debt that he owes, keeps pressure on the Lovet. And yesterday we saw the Rashbam and the day before, who said the reason is that here he gets a receipt for partial repayment of the debt, and then the Lovet is fearful of losing that receipt, because if he loses that receipt, he's got to pay the full amount again. So therefore there's pressure on him to get the remainder of the repayment done before he loses the receipt. And that keeps him anxious and wanted to pay it off, because then otherwise he might lose the receipt, or he might be collected against him with this document the full amount if he can't produce the shover. So that keeps the pressure on him. That's the way the Rashbam learned it. And we quoted again the Ramban, both yesterday and the day before, who says that the larger number keeps pressure on the Loveh, not because of what the Rashbam says, which is, we fear that the Malveh will come back if he loses the Shover. Rather simply, when you have a document of credit that is larger, it eats up the credit available to this individual. When creditors know that you've borrowed a larger sum of money, even though you repaid a portion of it, the only document that's left out there is that the full amount that you borrowed. So that's going to eat into the credit that people will extend to you, or keep pressure on you, because people know you have to sell property or liquidate property to pay off this larger loan. And that forces you to take a discount in the market when you go and sell your properties under duress. So that's what keeps the pressure on the Lovet. So again, for the Malveh, he has a vested interest in keeping the document consolidated as 100 rather than splitting it into 250s. Now, same is true the other way around, which is Venech the Lovet. The Lovet prefers it this way, because that will cause a pagam in the shtar. So the quote here of the idea of a pagam in shtar comes from the Mishnah in Ketubot, which is that a woman who is pogam ketubata, who ruins her ketubah, has to take a shvuah in order to collect the remainder of her ketubah. Now the word pagam is used in this context to mean that she admits to the fact that a portion of her ketubah was already paid out. So you have a woman who shows up in court with her ketubah, and she agrees that 10%, 40%, 50% of her ketubah were already repaid. In order to collect the remainder of her ketubah, she has to take a shvuah, which is hapugemet ketubata, a woman who agrees that her ketubah is not the full amount anymore, but a partial amount of the original documented amount. Lo tifra ela bishvuah. She's only allowed to collect with a shvuah. And here the Rashbam notes, Bo'adin the Chol Ashtarot. That's not unique to a ketubah. That's true of any debt document. So here, the Loveh has a vested interest in keeping the large number rather than splitting it to 250s. Because when the Loveh pays back half of it, the next time the Malveh, the creditor, comes to collect the remaining 50 in that shtar, he will have to take a shvuah in order to collect the remaining 50%. If it was two separate documents of 50, then when he paid him back half of it, then the guy would clear that shtar out and rip it up, and then he'd have another shtar remaining, which is the full amount of 50, and that he'd be able to collect without a shvuah. So again, the Loveh has a vested interest in keeping the larger number in the document, because then he can force the Malveh to take shvuah to collect the remaining amount of the document. Ve'omer Rovo, again here, Rovo or Rabbo, says the opposite is also true. Ha'imon denoket trei shtarei b'nei chamshin chamshin. Person who's holding two documents of credit that entitle him to a collection of 50 zuz from the same person, two documents to that effect. And he wants to consolidate it into one document of 100. Again, here, it's the Malveh coming to do it, or the Loveh coming to do it. Lo mishavinun le, we do not do that. We do not consolidate the documents. Avud rabbonon milta denech le malveh venech le loveh. Once again, the rabbonon said this for the benefit of both parties. Both the creditor and the debtor over here benefit from this institution. Because, nechalei lamalveh, it's the benefit of the creditor, keichidlo nifkim shtarei, because that will prevent the shtar from becoming pagum, quote-unquote, or forcing him to take a shvuah. In this case, if he's holding 250 documents, then when the debtor pays back 50, he just tears up one of the documents, and the other document remains outstanding for its full amount, and he won't have to take a shvuah in order to collect. Had he consolidated those together into a single document, then when the debtor pays back half, the next time the creditor comes to collect with the document, he'll have to take a shvuah in order to compel the debtor to repay the other 50% of the document. It's also to the benefit of the debtor, for the opposite reasons we said before, which is that the Loveh likes to have the smaller documents outstanding. Because then when he makes, quote-unquote, partial repayment of the total debt, then in that case, you'll rip up one shtar, and you'll have the other shtar outstanding. So that protects him, according to the reasoning of the Rishbam, from having to worry about the losing of the shover, the receipt, and therefore he doesn't feel the pressure to repay, because over here, the malveh can't come and collect that amount again, because we ripped up that part of the shtar. There's no need for receipt in this case. According to the Ramban, the total outstanding amount that is left there for you is 50. The 100 is no longer there because the other 50 was ripped up. So that actually increases your ability to borrow, or maybe the willingness of creditors to lend you money, as well as the pressure placed on you when you sell properties will not be considered as much duress because of the smaller amount of credit that is extended. So for those reasons, we don't allow the parties either to take a document that documents a larger amount and split it into two smaller amounts, or any amount of smaller amounts, and same is true and the vice versa. That if you have smaller amounts and you want to consolidate them up into a larger amount, we also will not permit that without the permission of both parties. Again, the Rabbanan did this for the protection of both parties. In each case, whether it's breaking it down into smaller parts or consolidating it up into a single entity, there are benefits and detriments to both parties. And because of that, we say that the Chachamim said that we don't allow you to do this in order to protect all the parties involved here, so that it's never done to the detriment of one of the parties. Amar Rav Ashi, Haiman Danoket Shtara Bar Mea Zuze, person's holding a shtar that entitles him to a collection of 100 zuz, V'amar Shavinu Nialei Chad Bar Chamshin, says to the sofer, rip it up, and write for me one shtar that says that I'm entitled to 50, that I can collect 50. Lo Mishavinu Le. Sofer does not listen to the creditor. Even though seemingly what the creditor is doing is to the benefit of the debtor, still nevertheless the sofer does not listen to him. My time, why shouldn't he listen to him? Amrina and Hai Mifra Pare, that this document was repaid. The Amarle Havli Shtarai. And the debtor said, give me back the document that evidences the fact that I owe you the money. The Amarle, and the creditor said, Irkusli, I lost it, it was burnt up. The document is no longer in my possession. Divle Tavro. And then he gave him a shover, a receipt for the amount repaid. So now what the Malveh is doing is says, listen, you know, I had this document that was 100 and says that I'm entitled to collect 100 and the debtor paid me back. But I lied and I didn't give him the shtar back. Or maybe I even didn't lie. I just said I couldn't find the shtar. And later on he finds the shtar. So he can't collect from the debtor because the debtor is in possession of a receipt that says that he repaid the amount. So the creditor says, you know what? If I come with the same amount or same claim, then he has a receipt to offset that or to say that I'm not entitled to it. On the other hand, if I come back with a different amount documented in the shtar, then I can say there are two different loans. One loan, yes, that amount you repaid. The other loan, which was for a different amount, a smaller amount, that you never repaid, and therefore you owe me the money. And that's why, he's going to take out this new document, this is a different transaction. So what the Malveh is doing is possibly cheating the Loveh by going in and asking for the number to be reduced. Even though it looks like it's to the benefit of the Loveh, it could turn out to be to his detriment because of the fact that maybe the loan was repaid already, and the receipt was handed to the Loveh. If you change the document, the receipt will no longer match up with the document, and therefore he can make another claim against this debtor. And that's why the sofer can't listen to the malveh to do this in this instance. Now the Tosfot asks, why didn't the Gemara bring this reasoning of Rav Ashi in the previous two cases as well, which is Shema Para? Maybe he already paid back the loan, and that's why you can't break this document down from 100 to 250, to consolidate from 250s to 100, because you can run into the same problem that Rav Ashi mentions in our case. The Balei Tosafot say that that's because the other two cases are Afilia Dina and She'enu Parua. But the other two cases of taking it from 100 and breaking it to 250s, or 250s and consolidating it to 100, is even in a case where we know that the loan is still outstanding and hasn't been repaid, the restriction still applies because we have these alternate reasons that would make it to the detriment of the parties. Although, according to the Ramban, over here, this statement of Rav Ashi, based on the Girsa of the Rabbeinu Hananel, applies to all of the cases. Meaning that the reasoning of Rav Ashi is not only applicable to his case, but also to the previous two cases. And the Balei Tosafot are acknowledging that and saying that if we don't have that information, then certainly that would be an issue in those previous two cases as well. Okay, now we see the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Shnei Achim, if two brothers who inherited their father, Echad Ani v'Echad Ashir, one of them is poor, one of them is rich. The father left them a bathhouse and an olive press. Asan Nischar, if in their father's day he rented these locations out, they were a vehicle for parnosa, they were income-generating assets, or according to some Rishonim, they can be made into income-generating assets. Then, Haschar Le'emtza, you continue to rent them out in that fashion, and the Ani and the Ashir will split the rental income, or the value that is generated by these two assets. Asan Le'atzmo, on the other hand, if the olive press and the Beit HaMerchatz were personal items, things that he used for his own purposes, he did not rent them out. Hare Ha'ashir Omer La'ani, the wealthy individual can say to the poor person, Kach l'chavadim v'yachatzu b'merchatz. Get yourself some servants, and he'll take you to the bathhouse, and they'll scrub you down and do whatever your needs are. You know, that part of the process of going to the bathhouse involved bringing individuals to service you in the bathhouse, both to provide you with towels, to scrub you down, to light the fires for the water, heating up the water. So he says, if you have your avadim, you can come and take a bath. Kach l'chazitim. You should acquire olives, ubavasa bebeit habad, and you can use the olive press. Or in essence, what the rich brother can do is compel the poor brother to use the locations the way that their father did. So these locations have to be used or have a chazaka of being used in a certain manner. So that means that if they were used to be rented out, then those are large numbers of people that are going to use them, and then the purpose is rental income, and the ani can collect that rental income just like the Ashir. On the other hand, if they were used for personal use, then there's a limited number of people that can come to this area, or for instance, the bathhouse. The Ani can't just say, listen, I can't make it, so I'm going to have other people come in my stead, or I'm going to bring large numbers of my family to the bathhouse. But that he can't do that, or he can't compel his brother to accept that, because that's not the way that his father used it. And the Yerusha, or the estate, is passed to the brothers in the manner by which it was used by their father. And therefore, the wealthy individual can say to the poor person, I'm sorry, if you don't have any use for it, then too bad. I'll use it from the use it was used by our father. And when you come into assets or whatever it is that would make it viable for you to use them, then you can use them as well. Whereas others disagree at the Rishvam and say he can replace himself with a rental as long as it's equivalent to what his usage of the property would be. Now, the Gemara earlier in the Masechta already said that we don't do what's called gold agud. Then we don't have here a put-call option, which is that one of the two parties can say to each other, listen, I want to dissolve the partnership. So over here would be the ani, the poor person saying, I want to dissolve our partnership. And therefore, I want to divide up the assets, and then I'm going to sell my portion. Now, obviously, these assets are not divisible, because an olive press is only valuable when it's whole. And same thing with the Beit HaMerchatz. So it's an indivisible asset. And we say the way that you deal with that is gold agud, which is that one person names the price, and the other individual makes a decision as to whether to buy or sell at that price. So now, you should be able to do that here as well. The ani should be able to compel the dissolution of the partnership. The problem, as the Rashbam notes, and as the Gemara said earlier, is over here that option is not available. Because gold agud only works if both parties can be parties to the possible transaction. One party names the price, the other party gets to determine whether it's a sale or a purchase. Over here, the ani only has one direction that he can go in, and that is that he has to sell it. He can't purchase it. So then the gold agud doesn't work, because if the wealthy brother names the price, then the ani only has one option, which is to sell it, or vice versa. If the ani names the price, the ashir only has one option, which is to purchase it. And therefore, the mechanism which would keep this as a fair transaction doesn't exist because one of the two parties can't really play ball or participate in the transaction. So that option is not on the table in order to dissolve the partnership between them. Shnayim shayu be'ir achat. If two individuals were in a single city, shem echad Yosef ben Shimon, shem acher Yosef ben Shimon. They share a common name. Ein yocholim lotzi shtarchov ze oze. Neither of them could pull out a document of credit against the other party. So if one, Yosef ben Shimon, pulls out a document, says that Yosef ben Shimon owes me money, we don't know why he's in possession of the document. Is he in possession of the document because he's the creditor? Or is he in possession of the document because he is the debtor? Meaning, a creditor holds on to the document because that gives him right of collection. But if the debtor repays the document, then the creditor gives the document back to the debtor. So is this Yosef ben Shimon in possession of it because he's the creditor? Or is he in possession of it because he is the debtor? It's unclear, and therefore they can't have a shtar against the other party. Velo acher yocholotzi alehem shtarchov. Not only is that true in transactions between the two individuals who share the common name, it's also true of third parties. A third party can't be a creditor against one of these two Yosef ben Shimon's, because takes out a document and says, Yosef ben Shimon owes me money, then the Yosef ben Shimon he goes to can say, that's not me, that's my friend with the same name. Goes to the other party, he says, that's not me, that's my friend with the other name. And the individual who's the creditor can never compel one of the two of them to pay, because he can't prove which one of the two the document is written about. Of course, if you have a deem or witnesses to the fact, or to evidence which of the two it is, then of course he could collect and it would be a fine shtar chov. Nimtza lechad ben shtarotav, shtaro shel Yosef ben Shimon parua. So if an individual finds a receipt or a document within his documents that says that one of the documents of Yosef ben Shimon was paid, shtaro shnehem pruin, then that individual may not collect from either of the two parties, because he can't tell which of the two parties this receipt indicates that the document of credit was already repaid. Since he can't tell which of the two repaid, he now has to give both of them that right, and therefore he can't collect from either party. Ketzad yasu. So what should you do to avoid these problems? Yishaleishu. You should put in a third generation. If they're both Yosef ben Shimon, then put Yosef ben Shimon ben Yaakov. And the other one will be Yosef ben Shimon ben Naphtali. So you'll be able to identify them by putting in a third generation. V'imayu mishulashim. What happens if they have identical names, even going back to their grandparents? So then, ichtavu siman. You should use a physical character trait of those individuals. The way that the Rishbam notes it is, the short one, the tall one, and you can come up with other physical character traits that would possibly identify, really, in this case, contrast the two individuals so you know which of the two it was speaking about. What happens if they look similar or they have similar features and there's nothing that would be clearly identifying between them? Yichtivu kohen. Then you can use a title as a way to differentiate between the two. So as much as possible, we will try to come up with a way to differentiate between two individuals with the same name. Again, we'll try to use another generation, or we will try to use a character trait, or we will try to use a title to separate or differentiate between them. And once you've done that, then you don't run into the problems that our Mishnah noted before. Obviously, today, with surnames, you could use that as well to help you out in these situations. Haushtara, the Nafak the Beit Din of the Rav Huna. So there's this shtar that shows up in the Beit Din of Rav Huna, the Havaktiv Beit. This is what literally is written inside of the shtar. Ani ploni bar ploni, I so-and-so, leviti manem imcha, borrowed 100 zuz from you. And the word you pronoun is used over here. It doesn't identify who the creditor is. Or in essence, what this document says is it is a bearer bond. Whoever is holding out to the bond, the you refers to. I borrowed money from you. Who is the you in this situation? The you is a person in possession of the document. So it's the equivalent of what we call a bearer bond. So the creditor shows up in court, in Rav Huna's court, and says, here's the document that so-and-so owes me money. The me is not identified in the document. It just says you. The debtor is identified in the document. So, Amar Rav Huna, bimcha, afilu mireish galuta, vafilu mishvor malka. When it says over here that you could even mean the exilarch. You could even mean the king. How do we know what the you refers to? And so here the Rashbam reads this is mashma afilu mi resh kaluto klomar shema resh kaluto adam acher hilvav v'nafal mimenu mitzato. A bearer bond has a huge risk. It's true of bearer bonds in general, which is that you have no identifying mark in them that tells you who owns the bond. And that's a risk with bearer bonds. That's why all the robberies and heists that took place when you had bearer bonds went after bearer bonds, because there's no way to trace the bearer bond or to trace who the real owner of a bearer bond is, because the owner is the one who bears it. So too, the Rav Huna is suggesting here, according to the Rashbam, that a bearer bond is too risky, because it's a possibility that the person holding it here is not the true creditor. It could be that he picked it up. Someone else dropped it. It could have been dropped from the exilarch. It could have been dropped from the king, and he picked it up, and now he's declaring himself the creditor. And therefore, Rav Huna says, I can't allow you to collect based on this document, because who says that you are the you that is mentioned there that says that I owe you, how do you know you're the you? Or how do we know that you're the you that's mentioned in this document? Now, that's the way that the Rashbam explains it. If you look in the Balei Tosafot, he says, V'ein nira adari mashupifarish. Afilu merish gadluto shenu choshishim shem adam acher hilvau v'nafau mimenu umitza'o zeh. So he says that the way that the Rashbam explains it is incorrect, and that's the way that we read it. Whereas the Balei Tosafot read it, Mimcha afilu merish galuta is lashon she'ela, is a question. V'hachi perusho. Afilu merish galuta she'in regula avot. The document mentions in there the exilarch who normally doesn't borrow money. So then we're going to say that he's allowed to collect from the exilarch based on this document. And as the Balei Tosafot note, it's a lashon she'elahu. It's a question. Rav Huna is not making this as a statement of fact, rather is positing it as a question. Are we going to assume that despite the fact that this is an individual who normally doesn't borrow money, we would still say that he's borrowing money here based on the documentation? Or do we look at this document as being a made-up or fairy-tale type of document? And so therefore, Rav Huna is questioning whether we really can collect with such a document, and that's why the Tosafot calls it Lashon She'ela. So according to the Rashbam, the fear that we have here, or the reason Rav Huna is rejecting the document, is because the possibility that it's a bearer bond, and it fell from someone else, and therefore you're not the true owner or the true creditor over here. And that's the question of Rav Huna. The Balei Tosafot reject that understanding, say it's a Lashon She'ela. When it says, I so-and-so, that I so-and-so, even if it's the exilarch, even if it's the king, you're going to now be allowed as a creditor to collect from those individuals? You have this document that says, I, the king, owe you the money. Kings don't borrow money. Yet, since you have this document, you're going to be able to go and collect from the king. It's clearly a problematic document, and therefore we're not going to abide by it, or we're not going to allow you to collect based on it. So that's the way that the Balei Tosafot read, Afilu Meresh Galuta, Afilu Mishwar Malka. So Amalei Rav Chista, the rabble. So Rav Chista, the Talmud of Rav Huna, says to Rabba, poke Ainba, go look into this matter, do the Urta Baila Rav Huna Minach. Because Rav Huna is going to ask you about this issue in the evening, because he now seemingly won't allow the creditor to collect with his document. He's going to ask of you to give your opinion about this matter. Nafok Dok V'Ashkach. He went ahead and looked into the matter and found that Tanya, we have a Braita that seemingly does not support this position of Rav Huna, but would give us the opposite conclusion. Get, sheyesh alav edim. You have a get that has edim signed to it. Ve'ein bo zman, but it's not dated. Aba Sha'ul omer, im katuv bo gerashtiha ayom, kasher. As long as it says in the document that I divorced her today, then it is a kasher get. Alma, what you infer from this braita is, hayom, ha'uyoma denofik pe, mashma. When it says that today I divorced so-and-so or this woman, when that document shows up in Beit Din and they're reading it, it says, today I divorced so-and-so, today means today, literally today. So even though it's an ambiguous term, because today obviously always means the day that you're on, and therefore it doesn't seem to have a date in it, what we assume is that when he says today, it literally means the day that it shows up in Beit Din. And that will be the equivalent of dating the document the current date, or the current day. Hachanami, and that's what we'll see over here similarly, Mimcha, Me'ahu Gavra, Denofek Mituta Yedei, Mashmo. From you means from the person bearing the bond, the person who is holding on to this document of credit, he will be the identified party. So you see here, when you have a language that is always true, like the case where it says, I so-and-so owe you, I owe you, always makes the creditor, or the person who's bearing the document, the one who's entitled to make that collection. So over there where the you or the creditor is unknown, but the way that the shtar is written makes it that whoever holds the document is considered to be the you, similar to what we found by the get. That is, even though there's no date in it, but it says today, any day you're standing on is considered to be today, but unless we will assume that the day means the day that Beit Din receives it, the day that it comes before Beit Din, that is the current date, and therefore there is equivalent of a date in the shtar. So it's over here, when it says you, it's the equivalent of the creditor's name being placed in the shtar, the one who's holding the document. So that's how Rabba wanted to solve this problem, or in essence, disagree with Rav Huna. Now Rav Huna posed it as a Lashon She'ela, or a Bitmiya, as a question, seemingly rejecting the right of this creditor to collect. Rav Chista said to Rabba, go look into the matter and see what's your opinion, and here Rabba comes back with an opinion that says he thinks Rav Huna's thought is incorrect, and that he should have a right of collection with this bond. Amarle Abaye, so Abaye is a Talmid of Rabba, says, V'dilma Abba Shaul k'Rabbi Elazar svirle. How do you know that? The reasoning behind Abba Shaul's position is that when you say Hayom, today, it means as if there's a date written in the document. Maybe the reasoning behind Abba Shaul's position is that he holds like Rabbi Elazar, Damar Edeich Nisira Karte, who says that the witnesses of the transference of the document, or in this case, the granting of the get, are what make it effective. Avahocha, in our case, lechush lenefila, you should worry about it falling. So over here, you need a little bit of background, which is that the Mishnah in Gittin says that there are three Gittin which are psulin. There are three types of Gittin which are invalid. Despite the fact that they're invalid, if a woman gets married based on that get, the vlad is kasher. The vlad is considered to be kasher and not to be pasul. On that Mishnah, Rabbi Elazar makes a comment and says, Rabbi Elazar Meir, afopi she'in alav edim, ela she'natnu la bifnei edim, kasher. One of those documents, one of those gitin, is a get that doesn't have any edim signed to the document. So that's a pasul get. Rabbi Elazar commenting on that says, afopi she'in alav edim, even though there are no edim on this document, as long as it was given in front of Edim, it is kasher. So that's one of the three gitin that are mentioned there in Perek HaMigurish. One is a case of katab b'ktab yado, it's written in the handwriting of the husband, v'en alav Edim, and there are no Edim signed to it. That's the case that we just discussed, where Rabbi Elazar says, even if there are no Edim signed on it, it's a kasher get, as long as there were Edim that witnessed it. Yesh alav Edim v'en bozman, there are witnesses, but there's no date on the get. Or it has the date, but only one witness signed to the document. So we're going to focus on the first two of those. The first of which is you have a document, a get, written up in the handwriting of the husband, but no edim signed on the document. So according to the Tanna Kamma, Obi Rabbi Meir, then the get is a pasul get because it's the signatories of the get that make it a kosher get. On the other hand, Rabbi Elazar believes edim misira karte. It is the edim that witnessed the giving of the get from the husband to the wife that make it an effective get. So that's what Rabbi Elazar says over here. Just because you don't have edim signed in the get, doesn't make it into a pasul get. The reason that they have to sign in the get is mipnei tikkun olam. It's at the kanad rabbanan, so that we'd be able to find the witnesses. We'd be able to get the information or know who the witnesses were. But it's not the thing that makes the transaction over here, the get, effective. What makes it effective is those that witness the actual conveyance of the document to the woman. And so there, Rabbi Elazar says, it is kasher. Then, as the Rashbam notes over here, v'heichad Rabbi Elazar makshir le'blo edim, just like Rabbi Elazar is makshir, the document, the get, without edim signed on it, mishum time of the edim isire karte, because the edim isire are the most important edim, hachinami makshir le'blo zman. So too, Rabbi Elazar will say that a get without a date in it is valid, mishum haitaim agufei, for the same reasoning, which is that the reason that edim sign on a get is for b'tnei tikkun olam. Similar, the reason that you write the date into a get is mipnei tikkun olam. It's because we don't want someone covering up for a woman who has a extramarital affair. Where the Gemara specifically speaks about a case where it's an uncle who married his niece, and he doesn't want to see his niece be put to death for this extramarital affair, and therefore he will write a get without a date in it, which will then allow the woman to escape the punishment that she deserves, or also the possibility that it will delineate the date where the Baal is stopped from being able to utilize the peirot of the Nechzei Malok. So too over here, the reason that it would be kasher according to Rabbi Elazar is that edim is sire karte. Just like the edim who witnessed the transference of the document from the husband to the wife, or what make the get effective, so too, they will be the ones who testify about the date. So even the absence of the date in the document can be compensated for by the Edei Misira. And so what the Baye is suggesting to Rabba is maybe the reason behind Abba Shaul over here, who says when the document says Ayom in it, why is it a kosher document? It's not because the Ayom is considered to be the date, but rather because he holds like Rabbi Elazar. And Rabbi Elazar says that these issues of Mipnei Tikkun Olam, which is the signature of the Edim to the document, as well as the dating of the document, are enhancements, l'chatchilo. But b'diavad, if they're absent, then the Edim Misira can compensate or make up for those deficits. And that's why Abba Shaul says it's kosher over here. Ah, why does he require that you say Hayom in the document? So that the Rashbam explains, v'Abba Shaul yadayim mochichot, The reason you need it today to be written into the document is because we don't know if the husband really intended to divorce with such a document. They need evidence of the fact that this is a document of divorce that he wants to be effective. So the word today in there makes it that we know that the husband is serious about this document being a get and being a get immediately. Because if it did not have the word today in it, then it might be possible they had never had any intent to divorce her. Not today, maybe not for a year from now, maybe never. We just don't know because the document, absent a date, doesn't have any indication as to where he thinks or wants it to go effective. So the word today overcomes that deficit and just makes it clear to us that the husband does want a divorce with such a document. So now, Abaye, based on that suggestion, says that maybe you have no proof from that case by Gittin to our case over here. Maybe that case by Gittin is unique because of Rabbi Lazar's opinion of Eide Misira Karte. But our case, Lechush Lenefila, let's worry about the fact that the bearer of the bond, the original creditor, dropped the document, and this individual picked it up. So that would be a different reason, or another reason to believe that maybe the din should be different over here than it is by the case of Gittin. The Baalei Tosafot don't agree with this position of the Rashbam, that the reason for Ayom is to be Yadayim Mokrichot, according to Abba Shaul, because the Baalei Tosafot say, why is the Rashbam all of a sudden coming up with this new reasoning and new issue that Abba Shaul is addressing, where we never saw such a thing in the Gemara? And therefore he believes that the word Hayom over here is not like what the Rashbam says is to prove that he's really serious about giving the get, or that he wants the get to go effective, but rather it's coming to obviate the possibility that there were conditions built into the giving of the get. Hayom is lo mishum detzarech zman, al mishum imatnal pet, shum tnai, because if there was any oral conditions that were embedded in this, all it does is it gives the retroactive effectiveness of the get to be from today rather than at the time that the condition is fulfilled. And that's the reason for the mehayom. It's just to make the get effective immediately given the condition is fulfilled, whether it's that he passes away, whether that he dies from this sickness or any other condition he embedded in it. Mehayom makes it that the get will be, the effective date of the get will be from today. And that's why Me'ayom is in the document, not because we need a date in the document, but rather because we want to know when the document went effective. And that's Me'ayom. And that's what the Ayom does over here, because otherwise there's a possibility that the get wouldn't be effective until a later date based on that condition or that oral condition that was stipulated, or a possibility that he made a condition that was Lachar Mita. It was after his death when the get cannot be effective. So Me'ayom, or Hayom, takes care of that problem and makes the get effective immediately if the condition is fulfilled. And as the Baalei Tosafot point out, what Abaye is saying is that if you hold like Rabbi Lazar, then the word Hayom doesn't mean what we thought, which is the date, but rather Hayom is Mashma Yoma the Nafak Mi Balabayit, the day that it left the hand of the husband, and not the day that it is found in Beit Din. If you learn that you need a date in the shtar, then Mahayom we're going to interpret to mean the day that it showed up in Beit Din, that is the date of the document. So then Mahayom means Ayom that it showed up in Beit Din. On the other hand, if you believe that you don't need a date in the document like Rabbi Lazar, then the meaning of the Ayom could be more narrow when saying the day that the husband gave this get, that's the effective date of the get. It doesn't mean any day. It's not a generic statement that any day that you're found, it means that day. It means the day that the husband gave it. If you do that, then the word mimcha that's found in the bearer bond could also have that more narrow meaning. In the document it says that I so-and-so borrowed money from you. That mimcha or that you could be read in one of two ways. It could be you, the particular individual, the particular creditor, or it could be you in the more generic sense means anyone who is holding this document. And so what Abaye is saying to Rabbah is just like by mehayom, where you thought it was a broader sense of mehayom, today means any day that it shows up in Beit Din, I'm telling you, maybe that's not the case. Me'ayom may have a narrower definition to mean the day that the Baal gave it, and so too the Mimcha. The you in our case may be more narrowly defined. It means you, the creditor, the one who extended me credit, not you, the person who's holding that bond or the bearer of that bond at any point in time. So Rabbah responds to Abaye and says, we don't worry about someone dropping a document. And how can I prove it to you that we don't worry about people dropping a document? It's not our Mishnah. You have two individuals with the same name in a common city. They're not allowed to, or they can't, have a document of credit against each other. And similarly, a third party can't take out a credit document against them. Ha! But what you can infer from a Mishnah is, Haim al-Akhirim Yecholim. They all have the ability to then take out such a document against someone else. Vamai. Why is that true? Lechush l'nefila. Why don't we worry about that one of them dropped it, and the other one picked it up? So, in this case, we'd said that they cannot be debtors, and they cannot take out a document against each other. But what the Mishnah does not say, and that's the inference that Rabbi's drawing, is that they can be creditors. There's nothing in the Mishnah that precludes them from being creditors. Yet, there is a risk that one of the two individuals was the creditor, dropped the document, and then the other one with the same name found the document, and now he's the creditor, even though he's not the true creditor belying the document. So what do you see from this? From our Mishnah, it seemingly concludes that you do not worry about the fact that someone drops a document. That even though the two of them share a common name, we don't worry about the fact that maybe one of them dropped it and the other one picked it up. But Abaye, what does Abaye do with this proof of Rabbah? It's very easy to understand the difference between this case and the case of Ravuna. When we're talking about it being dropped by one and picked up by one, that is a low probability event, and that we do not worry about. In this case, there's only one other party who could use this document. It's the other individual named Yosef ben Shimon. So if one of the Yosef ben Shimons dropped the document, it would only be valuable to one person in the remainder of the city. That's the other person with the same name. So that, we're not going to be choshesh for. That's a low probability event. That first of all, he dropped the document. And then, lo and behold, that person who picks it up is the individual with the same name. Now, the probability isn't as low as you would think, because there's a possibility that a third party found it and then gave it back to the other Yosef ben Shimon. He sees the name in the document. He says, oh, it belongs to Yosef ben Shimon. I'll give it back to him. So there is still higher probability than just the two of them or the other individual finding it. But nevertheless, it's still a lower probability that it'll end up in the other party's possession. On the other hand, in the case that we're speaking about here, where it's a bearer bond, there the worry or fear is not that this individual dropped it and one other person in the world could pick it up. It's anybody who picks it up. Because it's a bearer bond, then no matter who picks it up could become the creditor, even though they're not really the creditor to this transaction. And Tosfot just explains that probability in the opposite way around, which is that by the case of Chad, meaning that we're worried about one individual who will drop the document. Over here, it's only one individual who could possibly have been in possession of the document beforehand, one Yosef ben Shimon. We're not going to worry about that one individual dropping the document. Versus the case of the bearer bond, it could be anyone who dropped the bond. It doesn't have to be this particular individual or any particular individual, but it could be anyone who dropped the bond. And therefore, he says that the probabilities of one versus the probabilities of the Rabim are different. We explained it as being the one who finds it. That was determining the probabilities over here. But it does both speak about it from the perspective of the one who's dropping it. That in our case of Yosef ben Shimon and our Mishnah, there's only one person could have dropped it. This is the case of the bearer bond where anyone could have dropped it. So it's just another side of the same coin, which is that the probabilities are much lower in the case of Yosef ben Shimon to a Yosef ben Shimon versus the case where it's a bearer bond and therefore it doesn't matter who's in possession of it and it doesn't matter who dropped it. And therefore Abaye says that the statement that you're making, Rabbah, that l'nefila lo chayshinan is not true. We are choshesh for nefila, it just depends on what type of nefila. Remember, the nefila of one and then another one picks it up, you're right, that we're not choshesh for, that's our Mishnah. But when it comes to nefila, the Rabim, where the bearer bond can be dropped, and then anyone in the public could pick it up, over there we do worry about such an event. Velaha d'tanyo. But what about this right though? K'shem shein motzim shtarchov zelzeh, kach ein motzim alachirim. So now, over here you have a brayta that says that it's bidirectional. Just like nobody else can take out a credit document against them, so too, they can't take out a credit document against other parties. So now we have a braita that seemingly argues on the diuk that Rabbah made in our Mishnah. So what's the difference between the braita and the Mishnah? The answer is, yot, niknot, b'misira, kamiflegei. They're arguing about whether you can transfer ownership of a credit document by simply handing that document to another party. Tana didan savar, our Tana believes, otiot, niknot, b'misira. that you have the ability to transfer ownership through simply handing over the document. And therefore, the nefilat echad, the fact that it was dropped by one of them, picked up by the other, that we don't worry about. What's the possibility that he gave it to the other party, and he can then collect with it? That's not a problem. And since you, through transference of ownership, simple handing over the document, you can acquire possession of it, then whoever holds the document is the collector, or the right collector of this document, whether they are the original creditor, or whether they're the creditor because the other individual gave them the document. Either way, that is a valid means to collect. V'tana baro sovar, and the outside tana, I mean, the author of the Braita says, eino diot niknot b'misira. And therefore, the loved, the debtor, can always say that you're not my creditor. It was the other Yosef ben Shimon that was my creditor. The loved can say the following. The debtor can say to this creditor, Yosef ben Shimon, that's coming and say, v'yomar pikadon hu etz lecha. You're holding onto the shtar as a pikadon. V'zeh yomar in a shtar b'yadcha. And to the other individual, the other Yosef ben Shimon, he say the shtar is not in your possession to collect it. So therefore, neither of you have a right of collection. One is because you're a shomer, and the other one because you don't have the document in your hand. So over there, you can't just say whoever's holding the document has the right of collection, because the ownership can't be transferred to that individual. So unless you are the true owner of the shtar, you're not going to have a right of collection, absent the ability of these parties to write a harsha'ah, or basically a power of attorney to each other, which allows them to collect jointly, by which then the loved, the debtor, would not have the ability to be docha them, because one of them is coming with the power of both Yosef and Shimon's, and then the debtor would be compelled to pay in that case. You can't say that you don't have the shtar that entitles you to that collection, but absent that harsha'ah, according to the Braita, you would not be able to collect based on the Braita with such a document. All right, we're going to start up here, six lines down on Kufayin Gimel Amud Aleph, and tomorrow we'll continue with the Bayit Eima, an alternate way to explain the machloki between our Mishnah and the Braita.